Hello.
And welcome back to This Is Not
a History
Lecture.
Oh man, oh man.
It is episode 142.
142.
And that means it is not a theme, and I don't believe we're in a Heritage Month right now.
Nope. Okay. It's just October.
Good, otherwise I messed up.
I mean, you know, if you want the Heritage Month to be Halloween, then you can do that.
That is true. Which we've got a couple cool themes coming up. Well, cool topics.
I also did something a little Halloween-y today. Okay. So.
I wondered. I had one in mind, but I kind of switched it up just because, I don't know. I felt like I wanted to save the good Halloween stuff for the actual
episodes. Went back and forth on what I'm doing. Well, we just say. Yeah. That's what we do.
Today, I will be talking about Lagertha.
Oh, that's really familiar. What is that?
She's a Norse woman who may not have even existed as far as we know. She's kind of a mystery, which I felt like was kind of spooky and fun, but not spooky, just kind of like mysterious.
Yeah.
We'll get into her, but you probably, if you've heard the name Lagertha, it's probably in connection with Ragnar Lothbrok.
Oh, okay. That's probably why.
His first, presumably first wife.
Yes. Oh my God.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Who are you talking about today? Or what? Or where?
I'm talking about a book.
Oh, I don't know if we've done a lot of books.
I'm talking about a book.
Which book are you talking about?
Do you have any guess? Because it is Halloween.
Chaucer?
No.
Aesop's Fables?
No. You're thinking too.
Grimm's Fairy Tales.
No, this is like an instruction manual of sorts.
How to Get Away with Murder. Wait.
That's a TV show.
I'm thinking about like a codex or something.
It's referred to as a compendium.
Wait, what are you doing?
It's medieval, circa 1400s. I guess Renaissance-y.
Give it to me.
It's witches.
Is it a grimoire?
No. An instruction manual.
I don't know what this
on
is.
On how to deal with witches.
Oh.
You know what it is. It's the Malleus Maleficarum.
Oh. My brain was trying to think of what actually had compendium in the name.
No,
I was like,
no.
I don't know
it just is a compendium. Yeah. So I am
that's so cool.
I know. I was like, Kat's going to be so fucking excited.
I am. We're talking about cool female stuff.
Yeah, we got good stuff.
We got some
today.
Cool, like a cool ladies
episode. Yeah. Yeah. So, because I didn't want to overstep the Halloween episode we
right.
had planned.
Right.
But I was like, but I gotta.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Because this is a big piece of that we have
okay.
planned.
Mm-hmm.
And it deserves its own episode.
Oh my God.
So.
I'm excited.
Yeah. Yeah. If you want to hear about either of these things, which I promise that you do, you should stick around to find out why.
This is not a history lecture. With Kat and Kaylee.
Okay, well, it's only been a couple days since we recorded last, but I feel like I've worked an entire work week in those few days.
It's been chaotic for you.
It's only been 2 work days, but we had our yearly big event, and so one of those days was setting up, and one of those days was the event itself, which is why I appreciate you moving this to Sunday, because...
Yeah, I understand. That's a big one.
It's a big day. It's a big day. But it went really, really, really well. There was also an eclipse in Texas yesterday, so that was a lot of fun to see, and especially a lot of fun to like work a museum event for an eclipse or like that has an eclipse element to it, and it makes me really excited for the total eclipse in April in Texas.
There's a big one coming through Texas that'll be very big,
and I'm definitely gonna go see it, because are you kidding?
I know,
it's only so often that like a total solar eclipses are close enough for you that you can like drive to go see it. So I'm super excited for that. And it was just cool. It was just cool. It was a great day. And we did like a prize booth this time. We did like a passport system and a prize booth. And so it was like a lot of fun to see like the kids and everything get really excited about it. And I asked them like, oh, what was your favorite part? And they were like, everything. And I was like, it was all really cool, wasn't it?
I love that.
So, and this event is like my team specifically puts it on, like me and my boss and then our GA and our student worker, like
also don't let me forget to talk to you about that other thing that you texted me about earlier this week that I forgot to text you back about this morning, because I was waiting till I could talk to you about it in person, and then I was like
yeah
but that's awesome. I didn't realize it was like I mean, I did realize it was mostly your team, but like, mm-hmm. I'm glad it went off without like any real hitches and that it went so well.
Well, there was one hitch on Friday. Because so we open at 10, but you know, we've been there for a couple
I heard hours about this
at that point. But there,
I heard about this.
There's a blackout. Our power.
A big one, too.
A big one.
Like, multiple city
and
blocks.
And it was right after we opened.
Mm-hmm.
Like, 10, 15 minutes after we opened. I'm, like, standing in my boss's office talking with her, and the power goes out, and I just
look
up.
There's no windows in there,
and,
so, like.
No, it's dark. And then I look up. I'm like, no. I think it said something like, no way. Like,
this can't happen today.
No way. This is not happening. Because, you know, we had to set up for the event.
Yeah.
And, like, we could have done a lot of it, like, if we had closed and mm-hmm. then, like, just stayed a little later and done it without guests in the building would have been one thing. But we had to do shit upstairs.
Yeah.
And there's elevators not working. And we had to, like, haul tables and TVs and blah, 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 all that stuff upstairs. And
I heard it came back within, like, the next hour or so.
It took an hour. Yeah.
Which is still a lot.
Which is a long time for a blackout. And to just, like,
thankfully, we're not,
have
it's not
guests
112
in the
degrees.
Yeah.
Right,
so
now.
We actually had a big school group that had just gotten there. And they ended up taking them. We have, like, a back area and taking them out back because there's, you know, light outside.
Yeah. It was nice weather this week.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice and, for Texas standards.
Yeah. And it was just, yeah, I had 4 volunteers in the building. So, like, when it first went out, I had to, like, chase them all down. Like, where are the volunteers?
I've lost the children.
So that was, like, eventful. And then later that day, like, randomly, nothing happened. And one of my volunteers watched an emergency light fall from the ceiling and shatter.
I did hear about that, too.
Yeah, I bet you did. Because your friend was right there. And first of all, he played it off like, it almost got me. And he was, like, way around the corner. No, it didn't. My volunteer was sitting, like, 10 feet away from it.
All I know is that either way, when I heard that y'all's power went out, which I heard from someone, I actually heard from someone who works in collections. Because mm-hmm. it's a huge problem up there if they lose power, if the generators can kick on or not, because, yeah. like, collections have to sit at a very specific temperature.
Yeah.
And this person was just like, so this is fun. Thankfully, it's not, like, 110 degrees, but we were kind of just joking about collections protocol. I was like, yeah. go blow on them and keep them cool, like, jokingly and yeah. stuff. But I was like, it hit me a few minutes later. I was like, haha, collections, haha. And then I was like, oh. It's yeah. the day before the event.
Yeah.
And they, yeah. oh no. I was yeah. like, they're either setting up or if this is going to happen again in the morning. Like, I was like,
yeah,
oh,
well, we
no.
were like, what are we going to do? Like, if this is out and we don't have power for the rest of the day, like, oh my God. And I'm pretty sure, I haven't checked my oven clock actually, but I'm on the same grid. I'm like 90% yeah. sure. And I'm sure my power went out too. But so that was fun. And then the emergency light falls, right? And the bulb, like, shatters everywhere. I'm all over the exhibit space where it is, and I'm, like, picking up shards of glass because it's carpeted mm-hmm. and they just got this big, like, play structure thing.
Was it in the traveling?
No.
Okay. Oh, the one in the yes.
Yeah, it was right yes. next to my office. Yeah. Yep. So I'm picking up shards of glass, and since we just got this new, like, big kind of foamy play structure thing, kids have been taking their shoes off because it's carpeted, and I'm talking to the exhibits or the facilities guy, and I'm like, hey buddy, should I real quick type up a sign that says at least don't take your shoes off because there's glass in the carpet? And he was like, that's fine.
It's like, no, this that's is a liability fine.
I'll send the housekeepers over to vacuum it up. My office is right there. I hear a vacuum all day.
Like, yeah, no.
And I was like, oh my God. And I was like stressed out because I was like, and I went over there earlier or later, and a kid sure enough had his shoes off. And he's like, oh, we probably picked up all the pieces. No, dude, it's glass.
Like, we should be vacuuming no matter what. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was like a whole thing because I was like, oh, I can't, like, you're the building guy.
Right. But
I can't, like, overstep.
But
you
also, liability wise, we should probably, like, take care of this.
We know that there's glass in this carpet. And we know the kids take their shoes off.
It's like, we need to do more than our normal due diligence here. Yeah.
I mean, he had a lot going on because he also is the one that has to deal with everything if the power goes out.
Yeah.
But
still, it's like.
But still. Yeah.
Abundance of caution
right.
in that
I know.
Situation.
And that's why I was like, I'm not asking him to do it. I would do it.
Yeah.
And just, like, tape it somewhere, yeah. you know. I've got access to the printer, too. So that happened. And then, like, later that day, like, a kid peed in our fire truck. And, like,
oh, no.
Yeah, it was just, like,
a day of.
It was definitely Friday the 13th.
Oof.
Yeah. So that was fun. And it's days like that, though. It's, like, something different. And you're like, ooh.
Like, okay.
And then also, I don't know if you've been down the Natural History Hall when there's, like, all the lights are out. But there are no emergency lights in that hall.
Oh, it's terrifying.
There are no emergency lights in that hall. Mm-hmm. Everywhere else is pretty well lit with emergency lights, mm-hmm. like pretty decently. But that hall, there's none.
And there's no windows, there's no light, there's no nothing.
There's nothing. And so me and my boss, we went around with our flashlights and like took stupid pictures. It was mainly me because I was like, I want to do this because it's hilarious to me.
How often do you get to?
How often? Right. I mean, I could stay late, but I don't want to do that. Plus, like, they set the alarm, and then that's a whole thing.
Then, yeah, you gotta be out.
But I took, like, the pictures and, like, trail cam footage of, like... Oh, my God. Every time I look at it, it cracks me up. Like, he's gonna eat me. Of all of our, like, kind of
it's
bad
the closest
taxidermy.
To night at the museum. Actually, we've had real night at the museum. We've had evening events there, so I can't say it's the only night at the museum vibes, but yeah.
I mean, it's like fun for the groups that were there because they took them through the hall when it was dark because everyone had flashlights and stuff. Mm-hmm. So it was like, ooh, you know. So, and then like our director was in the main area where everyone was kind of gathered, and we were like, hey, are we gonna close? What do we do? Because it had been like 30, 45 minutes at that point. And he was like, I don't know. It's like, dude.
You're paid to know.
You're the director.
Direct us.
Yeah.
If we had lost power, I'm sure, if we ever do lose power on our side of town, which I'm sure will happen at some point, I'm sure our boss is just gonna be like, I'm gonna just go home. She's been so chill lately, yeah. And since we're not like open to the public, it's been,
I was gonna
like,
say, like, it's a lot different when there's just staff in the building.
Oh yeah, the day that we like carried those logs everywhere, she's just like, go home.
Yeah,
she's like,
yeah,
just go home, guys.
Yeah,
and I was like, thanks.
Yeah. Also, our director's whole thing is that he wants us to be as open as possible. Like, he wants us, if we don't physically have to be closed, he wants us to be open, which I get. He wants us to be like consistent for the community and everything, and that's like one of his big things. But at the same time, like, dude, the power's out. Like, I don't know. The only other time there was a blackout that I was there for, it was like late in the afternoon, and so they just called it. Mm-hmm. They're like, it's 3:30. So that was fun. That was a fun day at work. And then they like have this requirement because most of the offices don't have windows, to like have everyone has to have a flashlight, not just available but like on their desk where they can grab it. Mm-hmm. And this one guy, he had like one of the kids' flashlights and someone had like given him, and it was so bad. And I was like, oh, buddy. I was like, don't worry, I'll get you a better flashlight. But yeah, so I knew where a bunch of flashlights were, and I went and got like a bunch of them, and I came down, and they were LED flashlights. They were good. And I came down with six in my hand. I was like, pick one. He was like, oh,
have an option, please.
Cause like where they were just sitting up in like a closet that we have a shelf in. And I was like, this is pointless them being up here.
Yeah.
You know? So I was like, here, you're nice. I'll get you a flashlight. So anyway,
sure, he's grateful.
Yeah.
I'm glad it worked out eventually. And
Yeah, it ended up being fine, but Friday was definitely a lot more exhausting, just the setup and making sure that everything was, like, as best as it could be to get going on Saturday. What? You don't like that?
I don't. It's, like, it's not as bad as chalkboard, but, like, I can feel it under my own nails. Ugh.
Okay, I'll stop.
It's okay.
But then Saturday, like, went off. Probably, like,
the best it could have.
Good. Like I me and my boss were talking about it, and I was like, honestly, like, everything else about this was perfect. Our only goal left, like, our goals have been to figure out what layout and what how to get people throughout the building the best as possible. And like, we did a lot to accomplish that, and I think we did it really effectively this year, and so all of that is great. Like, I don't think we have to worry about that, and we just do this again, you know.
Yeah.
But like our goal now is just to get attendance numbers up.
That's really good. That's great.
So it was pretty exciting. It's pretty exciting. Yay! Yeah. So
yay for events that actually go well.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's always like, and of course the eclipse brought a lot of people in because, you know, like, oh, who is going to have eclipse classes? A museum. Mm-hmm. Who's going to have something
right.
to do with an eclipse? A museum, mm-hmm. you know? So that definitely drew a big audience. And so well, it'll be interesting to see, like, in the future when we don't have an eclipse, if,
right,
you know,
if it has the same.
Yeah, magnitude. Yeah. Because it was, like, our biggest one of these events ever.
I wonder.
Attendance-wise.
Yeah.
So it's still not that goal that I, like, want it to be. But we were getting closer.
Yeah. Well, so. And for the town we're in and everything that's been going on this weekend, there's also a huge
and plus it was
race
like,
going on this weekend in our town that they, like, shut down a bunch yeah. of streets for and stuff. So there's a lot going on right
yeah.
now.
Yeah, and plus it was, like, the first weekend with truly nice and beautiful weather.
Yeah.
And so we were just competing with, like, also
every
other
institution.
Space.
Yeah. Yeah. All the people that haven't been to the zoo all year.
Exactly.
That,
like,
haven't been to
the I'm sure the
parks.
Zoo was popping this weekend.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I'll never wish for bad weather because we have a part of our event that is outside.
Right.
And,
it's just whether or not, is this the first week? Is this, like, the yeah. week everyone else is
right.
going out in it?
Yeah. Right. So it's just going to be the goal from this point on. I think it's just going to get our attendance to right about where we want it. And I don't want it to be, like, record breaking attendance days. Like, that's not what I want because
right.
those cause so much stress for staff.
Yeah.
So much stress. If we had 2,000 people at this event yesterday, like, all of the presenters would be dead and they would not want to do that again.
Right.
Like, we have to find a balance of getting them a good enough audience that they feel like they've really done
made an impact
what they came
and,
here
yeah.
to do
mm-hmm.
Versus exhausting them, staff, and just everyone involved, you know?
Yeah.
Because there's another event that's, like, kind of similar to this one.
Yeah.
That we don't even put on. We just host, like, as a museum.
Mm-hmm.
And that one is actually free and open to the public. We don't charge admission on that day. And we
yeah.
had a lot of people in, and that just exhausts everyone involved.
Yes.
Like, everyone involved is dead by the end of it. Even if your role is, like, super, super small in it, there's just so many people in the building that it... Yeah. Anyway, enough about my event. I'm happy that it went well.
Yeah, I'm happy for
so.
You.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And I'm excited to see where it goes in the future and everything, so...
It'll be very exciting.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah.
Yay!
I was gonna say, you might not have much to update on because
no, the
you just probably had a nice restful weekend.
The bad part of my week was already there. I'm slowly
yeah.
becoming less sore, but we are picking up a bunch of shelving and flat file storage on Tuesday from our sister museum in town, and it'll put me right back on, probably not quite as sore as lifting, you know, multi-hundred pound logs and all that stuff, but
hey, let's remember OSHA is a thing, you know.
Actually, only if you have a staff of what is it, 15 or more.
That doesn't mean that you can just
no
be
I know
abused.
I know but yes,
that
but
doesn't mean that my dad's crew of five people
is violating on purpose. I am aware.
Is like they can just, you know, disregard every safety precaution ever.
No, yeah, we'll be safe, and this shouldn't be as bad as what we did last week. And this will honestly be one of the last heavy lifting things for a while. After this, it'll be small stuff like just going through boxes, planning events, walking a couple parades. Hopefully, walking a parade is the closest we get to exhaustion.
Okay.
Which, with this weather, should be pretty good. So yeah. I'm looking forward to it. But yeah,
cool. Shall we hear all about
we shall.
Your lady?
Yes.
Your maybe existing lady, potentially
yes.
real lady?
Yes. Yes, we shall.
It's like, I have a girlfriend. She goes to another school.
She's in Canada. She
yeah.
just lives in Canada.
She moved. You don't
yeah.
know her. You wouldn't know her. She's, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we do know theoretically who Lagertha is. I was recently, I don't know if it's struck work. I think this series ended. But just in case it is struck work, I don't want to say the name. But I was recently rewatching a show that features Lagertha as a pretty main character, which is interesting because if you're looking at like the documentation we have of her, there's not a ton. But it really made me wonder, like, and I knew Lagertha was not a prominent figure because of how little documentation there is. But I was like, based on the documentation we do have, what from the show is kind of myth, what's real, mm-hmm. what can we actually verify, and where is the dramatization. So I also really just wanted to talk about a kick-ass woman. And
yeah,
because I haven't talked about a woman in quite a while. And she was very much so a kick-ass woman. So in summary, Lagertha was the legendary shield maiden, who was married to her husband was Ragnar Lothbrok, who in himself was sort of like a almost king during the 9th century. But she was first his wife, and in her own right, she was his first wife. But first and foremost, she was a kick-ass woman who carried a great deal of strength and respect and power and prowess in her military combatant abilities.
Mm-hmm.
So, I do want to note, I'm going to note it multiple times, because both the fact of where she's mentioned and how little she's mentioned have really big impacts on how we interpret her story mm-hmm. and her existence. She's not mentioned really throughout history, which could be because only certain materials have survived, but it could also be due to her status as a woman
mm-hmm.
throughout these stories, and kind of being married to a man who carries also his larger than life
right.
story. She just kind of got overshadowed yeah. or shoved to yeah. the side. Her name, you'll also see her listed sometimes as Lathgertha or Ladgerda. Depending on which translation of her name you're seeing. Just like the rest of her story, her name is a little bit up to interpretation, because that is kind of like the anglicized mm-hmm. version of her name. In our pretty much singular documentation of her, the only real information we have, it begins with a rather unconventional meet-cute story.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Love.
The king of Norway, his name was Sigurd, S-I-W-A-R-D, I believe, and this is the grandfather of Ragnar Lothbrok. He, being his own king of Norway, he has lands and holdings and alliances and all that stuff, but a Swedish king named Fro comes in and kills Sigurd. This... insult, but I mean, it's hard because if you know a lot about Vikings, I don't know as much as I probably should about the Vikings, but like the culture of battle and war is very unique. Like it's mm-hmm. like constant. I don't know if there's any cultures that are quite so like constant, just battling it out, like taking stuff from each other, like pillaging and plundering is part of the kind of society, kind of the expectations in this culture. Again, mm-hmm. like Kaylee says, sometimes it's a whole different world. We have to like view it yeah. as an alien thing. But either way, a king killing a king is gonna piss some people off. And Ragnar Lothbrok has just stepped up to a position of authority as well in his own family, in his smaller area. And when he hears that his grandfather has been killed and his grandfather's female relations have been put into some sort of sex work, or some say it was a brothel, et cetera, et cetera. Essentially that they were put to the female ancestors or family that were left had been somehow put into social shame. He retaliates. He goes to Norway directly to avenge his grandfather and their mm-hmm. legacy and kind of restore justice to the women who have been mistreated, because in their society at the time, that was a very shameful thing.
Mm-hmm.
When he arrives, he finds the unexpected. There is a group of these, quote, kind of shamed female relations. And they're just as mad about what was done to them and what was done to King Sigurd and everything. And they're ready to get just as violent in their retaliation and revenge. It said that they had even dressed up as in more traditionally masculine clothing and mm-hmm. Like male warriors almost, so that they might be prepared to aid Ragnar. And so Ragnar shows up and he's like, I will save the... Oh. Oh, okay. Okay. And they're ready to go to bat with him. And with such forces behind him, Ragnar retaliates, attacks the Swedish king, wins the battle... And he attributes, openly, a large part of his victory to the women, particularly one woman, who he credits with incredible ferocity and elegance. And
you know, Mm-hmm. I'd also be into it.
Of course, Lagertha is like, yeah, from all accounts, she's a beautiful, powerful woman who is just ready to like tear people apart, and that she was instrumental in his retaliation and his getting kind of his comeuppance. But the legendary love story, we don't even know if it's that romantic. I say it like this because it's just kind of a weird, fun story. And when we talk more about the possible origins of this story and its influences, it kind of makes more sense that it's almost a little outlandish. But
I don't care. Let me believe.
Lagertha is not so easily wooed. She apparently caught his attention by this account. Caught his attention very easily just by being her ferocious badass self. But Ragnar sets his sights on her, and she's kind of like, nah, okay.
Well, this guy.
This dude. It seems innocent at first. After the victory, she returns to her home in what is now Norway, and he continues from his home to send her messages, kind of missives that make it clear of his intentions to marry her. And she's kind of like, okay, I'll play along, but this dude's not like, he's not doing it for me, you know?
He's just some guy.
Yeah, he's been like so impressed, and she's kind of like, great.
I mean,
I kind of won a battle for you, like,
yeah, I was gonna say, she's got the right to not be wooed.
But he also finds out that she's pretty from a pretty high-ranked like family, like of noble birth almost, and just that family name kind of continues to egg him on a little bit, and he's kind of the popular ruler of his area. She's kind of like a prominent in hers and respected, and Lagertha knows what she wants, though, and she wants him to kind of either prove that he's worth it or die in the process so she doesn't have to deal with him. I guess she kind of encourages these affections, whether or not she's really feeling it. She kind of encourages it, and she's like, yeah, okay, I'll send letters back with him. But she's going to make him prove himself.
As she should.
According to the legend.
This is a courtship. Come on now.
It is. Prove it, man. Prove it. This woman helped you win a battle. When he finally arrives, thinking it's going to be this quick, hey, marry me, let's ride off into the sunset, or in Viking traditions, probably not quite so gently romantic. She's...
Vikings contain multitudes, Kat.
They do. And that's the thing. I don't want to say this was not intended, but I mean, no. For all we know, Ragnar had flowers in his hand and was ready. But she was not ready with flowers in her hand. He arrives after... She's returned his messages to an extent, so he arrives thinking like, oh, cool. We're just gonna get married, whatever. And shows up, she's like sent like this. She set this like perimeter of protection guarded by a bear and a hound.
And hell yeah, she
she's
did.
Like, hey, hell yeah, she you did. Want it? You gotta beat the bear and the hound.
No way.
He does. Unfortunately, / fortunately, depends on who you're rooting for. He's in for a surprise. He really expected this to be an easy win, and shows up and he's like, this woman who I saw fighting her battle with her hair down, falling over her shoulders in great power and prowess, and I've been riding her. And he's like, shit, I gotta win this. Hold up, hold my phone, guys. We gotta do
beer.
This. Hold my beer. he, with his mythical fighting skills, manages to, I believe, spear the bear and strangle the dog in a great show of his strength,
his might,
his worthiness. So it depends, I guess, here on how you interpret the legend. Is it, you know, this was a test to see if he was worthy, or did he just kind of like breach her perimeters and was like, now you're my wife, and she's like, well, damn, okay, like, was she happy about this? We don't really know a whole lot, and right. We'll talk more about why we don't know a whole lot later.
Yeah.
But from their union, after he either wins her hand or wins her affections, we don't know which is which, we have records of two daughters, neither of which is named, and a son named Fridleif, who is documented. Their married, blissful life is not always married and blissful. There's not a whole lot of peace, as we said before, in Viking culture. It's kind of a constant, like, hey, fight for your land, fight for what you need, take what you need, raids, etc. But we do know they have a decently peaceful union for about 3 years before unrest calls him back to his holdings in the Danish kingdom. So he returns to his homeland. He leaves Norway and Lagertha behind to go put down this unrest. And because of how other histories at this time are written and Ragnar Lothbrok's prominence in his own right as his own story, this is where we start to see some other written accounts of Ragnar's life where we can start to verify, like, oh, okay, this account matches up with this one, et cetera, et cetera. But it still feels a little outlandish sometimes. Mm-hmm. The same documentation that we were talking about before, though, that talks about Lagertha, with a little bit of backing from some others, tells us that Ragnar is introduced to a Swedish king named King Herod, who's offering a reward for his daughter's hand in marriage. Essentially, her name was Thora, and depending on the story, she apparently had some sort of fascination with snakes and had raised a bunch of them, or had been taken by a outlandishly, folklorishly mythical, large snake or verm or something of that type.
Mm-hmm.
Some serpentine
thing. Basilisk.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so, who comes forth to free Thora and win her hand? It's Ragnar. And Ragnar actively makes the choice to pursue Thora, wins her hand, and leaves his son Fridleif, Lagertha's son, in charge of his holdings back in Norway where Lagertha is. He ends up completing this challenge set forth by King Herod and everything, and has the permission to marry Thora. And divorce exists in Viking culture, which is one of those really interesting things that we see early on in early Christians, like, criticizing and stuff about how, like, sexuality is very different in Viking culture, and
mm-hmm.
man, we could do a whole episode about that. That's mm-hmm. It's really fascinating. But by the accounts we have, it almost seems that Ragnar sort of fell out of love with Lagertha, or remembers at least that she was willing to, like, kill him with a bear and a hound, because she was never like, I'm so in love with you. It's really hard to tell. Also, again, we'll talk about it later, because of the Christian retellings of the story.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know. Was it a mutual agreement that he and Lagertha didn't really get along anymore? Was he just like, oh yeah, you did try to kill me instead of marry me, I'm not here for that, bye. Like, we don't really know. But either way, he sets aside Lagertha and does go to marry Thora. Some stories, well, I should say, she doesn't disappear from history. She's mentioned again, but this is where we stop getting an actual account of what Lagertha mm-hmm. was doing.
Mm-hmm.
In these same writings, and these this chronology of writings by this author, she moves on with her life and gets married to someone, someone with power, but in no way compromises her strength and power as a shield maiden.
Hmm.
In fact, Ragnar turns to her again. They're fighting a battle. His son has fallen in battle. It's looking dire. They're going to lose her. Ragnar's other son is going to die by his other marriages. And he's struggling. And in a last-ditch attempt, he reaches out to Lagertha, who, whether it's magnanimous or whether it's a I still love you sort of thing, mm-hmm. she agrees to help. Mm-hmm. And knowing how strong she was in battle before, he tells her, like, hey, if you aid me in this military thing in my homeland, I'll give you, like, 120 ships in exchange for your assistance, mm-hmm. which is huge. Like, that is a, you know, whether or not she loved him, whether or not she was being magnanimous, or maybe she was just like, wow, 120 ships? Yes. I would like that, please.
Yeah.
She decides, hell yeah, pretty good deal. She shows up in time to sneak behind the forces that were attacking Ragnar and his son,
mm-hmm.
surprises them, and manages to win a victory on Ragnar's behalf.
Hmm.
Which is openly admitted in these texts that this is at least the second time, first with his retaliation against the king who married his grandfather, and now again to save his son, that Lagertha, he owes his victory to her.
Yeah.
So we do also have to discuss, because we're talking about Lagertha's, like, superiority in battle, we have to discuss shield maidens a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And you took a class on this. You took a class on Vikings. I never mm-hmm. got to take that class. Mm-hmm. Big sad. Archaeological evidence does not discredit the idea that there were women who could fight.
Yeah.
But what we have physically found from that time period in almost like what's the word, perspective to what we have written about, there is a discordant sort of,
right,
the written tales talk about
when you compare them,
shield maidens, and yeah, like how vicious, right, they were and how many of them there were, but our archaeological evidence is disproportionate, is, yeah, what the word, I guess, is. We have, yeah, not found quite as much. We found stuff that, yes, female Vikings could fight and they were valued as fighters, but the modern interpretation we have because of like written and oral reports,
right,
about them being like their whole own armies and their whole like shield maidens being these vast, fierce, common thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so common as our current perception might suggest.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if y'all talked about that a lot.
We did a little bit. We didn't talk about shield maidens a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Which
probably because there's probably not a lot of historic archaeological backing, yeah, for it.
I think the conversation with anything that you talk about with Vikings is the text we have from them, and we're lucky that we have a lot of text from them,
mm-hmm,
relatively speaking. How much of it is like their lore,
mm-hmm,
and their kind of mythology in a way?
Yes.
Versus how much of it is representation of real life,
mm-hmm,
right? Like, you know, the question of, was this lady even real?
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And for the people who are real, you still can't be like, yeah, this guy did this, this, and this.
Yeah.
Because it's like, did he really, though? Like,
were you hyping him up?
Or
were you like trying to get people to follow him?
Yeah. Or like you just kind of contributing to the whole, like, it's great to be a Viking, and like your, yeah, own kind of self-image and like creation of a culture and an identity around,
mm-hmm,
being, you know, they don't even call themselves Vikings, you know,
like, right.
So it's always a question of like, how much of this can we take as literal fact?
Yeah.
Versus, you know, how much of it is actually what life was like. Mm-hmm. So it might be that like women, and like you said, there is proven without a doubt that women did participate in battle,
mm-hmm,
not to the extent potentially,
mm-hmm,
that it's written about, but there is still that element of truth in those, mm-hmm, stories. And like when you were trying to create like essentially a national identity, like,
right,
a group identity and something to kind of rally behind, then you're gonna, you know, spice things up a little,
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, exactly. And we do have like confirmed other accounts of kind of these quote shield maidens, probably the most famous being Freydis Eriksdotter, who is the sister to Leif Erikson.
Yeah.
And accompanied him during his and documented, yes, saga, seen, to Vinland.
If you've seen SpongeBob, that is, yes, yes, that is Leif Erikson.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
It's been too long since I watched SpongeBob. I didn't even ever put that together.
Yeah.
Oh my god, you're right.
That's like the first thing. I was like, oh, that's just not something SpongeBob just made up.
Oh my god. I didn't even piece that together. Well, yeah, like we have her documented, and not only accompanying him while she was pregnant, but that when, like, when she was helping Leif in his settlement in her early years and everything, that at one point she even scared away potential invaders with her like ferocity and like bearing a sword and like ready to go at them and everything.
Yeah.
So we have, you know, like a pretty well documented existence. It's,
yeah,
again, it's what is, yeah, like romanticized or
right,
larger than life.
Mm-hmm. Aggrandized,
that's a great word for it. And as well, we also, in folklore like this, this is where we start seeing things like the concept of like the Valkyrie.
Mm-hmm.
And like there's, if you're thinking about this, like women who run into battle fearlessly with their hair down and all that, you start to see like some really interesting similarities, yeah, here that you're,
well,
like,
and then it's also,
did their religion and folklore,
right,
inspire them to do this?
Right.
Or are the stories of their conquest, mm-hmm, inspired by their religion?
Right.
Like,
yeah. And then it's also like, now looking back in our conception, like modern conception of stories like that, it's like we are so desperate to hear of basically women being empowered in some way,
mm-hmm,
that we're going to cling on to the few examples that we have,
yeah,
and really like unintentionally,
yeah,
you know, kind of aggrandize those,
mm-hmm,
yeah. So how much of that conception is the modern just wish for it to be something that it wasn't?
Yes.
You know, because these texts are translated,
yes,
you know,
and there's a lot of bias in them too, not,
yeah,
just from the authors,
yeah,
and we'll get into this particular author in a second, but like I remember too, who is it that wrote the documentation about the Vikings? It was some Eurocentric culture But like someone, it's gonna kill me. They wrote about how like the Vikings had some sort of like magic or witchcraft because women kept falling in love with them and stuff like that. And like, and it's really like, well, the Vikings bathed.
Yeah.
Plot twist. Yeah. Your bias is showing a little bit because it's not that your women are falling in love with these mythical men. It's they bathed and they groomed. I know you're talking and like, about. It's kind of funny. It's like,
well, and then too, it's like the whole conception that they were dirty and gross. And when actually, for all we know, they were probably cleaner than like the average European at that point.
So it is really, again, these biases are so contextual in history that we have to kind of question everything. And that's why I was really glad that each of the articles I read was like, hey, up front, we do not know if Lagertha existed.
Yeah.
Like we've got one documentation that mentions her.
Right. Yeah.
One.
Yeah.
We have more that mention Ragnar.
Right.
But only one that mentions Lagertha. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in that one account of Lagertha, post her helping out her ex-husband here, the opinion of her wildly changes. We see it kind of take a turn. Because here in the story, the author no longer, he doesn't favor Lagertha. According to him, Lagertha is on sort of this like victorious high after winning this battle for Ragnar, and she returns to her village with a weapon concealed somewhere on her dress. She was married to a ruler or a prominent leader of the community and takes the weapon that she had hidden in her dress and runs her husband through, murders him, and takes the power for herself.
Murder.
This is where the author really seems to lose any respect for her, which is hard to know because, like, why didn't she kill her husband? Like, maybe she was like, hey, maybe it was, like, a not good situation and she was being taken advantage of and she was like, I'm done. I'm coming back and I'm killing you. Or maybe she wanted his power, in which case, culturally, like, nowadays we would demonize her for murdering someone for power. But, like, at the time, murdering for someone for power would not be a shocking thing.
Well, also, like, the Vikings were pretty much, they were pretty into that idea of, like, okay, yeah.
You're dead. Go to Valhalla.
Yeah.
If you can make it.
Right.
Like, and so it's really interesting to see his complete opinion of her change because she killed her husband. And the historiography here, this is where we get to talk about it. But it radically changes how he sees her, but how he tried to portray her. Because we don't know. Was she in her right to kill her husband? Was it abusive? Maybe. Was it... And would we be questioning it if a man had killed another man for his power? Right. Like, that would just be part of life.
I mean, like, how many times has that happened even in the Viking texts?
Right. You know?
Like, dozens, probably.
Yeah, it seems like he's almost, the writer is portraying her as this kind of, like, Jezebel. Like, this, like, traitor because she was married, because she couldn't handle sharing the power with her husband and ruling by his side, that she wanted all for herself, that she's a traitor and she's power hungry because she's a woman. And this is where we get to talk about well, actually, give me one more sec before we jump into that. For whatever reason she murders him, it does not discount the fact that Lagertha is a very strong woman, and the author acknowledges that. Like, even if he doesn't like her, and he even kind of tells her that, like, calls her, like, a presumptuous woman and stuff like that, that either way you, look at it, Lagertha, in his account, is a strong woman. Even at some point, she shows up in correlation with Auslaug, who is one of Ragnar's other wives, who actually, you might not know Auslaug's name, but she's the mother, wife of Ragnar, but mother of Bjorn and Ironside and Ivar the Boneless. Like, the two very famous figures in this part of history. Both of these women, though, Auslaug and Lagertha, would fight with a head to lead their children in battle to assist Ragnar and in their own pursuits. So it's not like other women from this time aren't acknowledged in this story as powerful. And the last thing that we see of Lagertha in this account is that she kills her husband and she takes some sort of power. We don't have a death date. We don't have a what happened next, if she was murdered, if she died of old age. She's kind of lost to history. And what we know, so this whole account that I've been talking about this whole time, it's called the Gesta Danorum, I believe is how it's pronounced. It's written by Saxo Grammaticus in the early teen centuries, and he really treats Lagather like a side note to her husband's accomplishments, which is very unfortunate. But he's also writing this hundreds of years after Lagertha and Ragnar mm-hmm. would have existed. Mm-hmm. So he's relying on almost no primary documents. He's relying on oral histories, which we know can get very linked with folklore very easily.
Mm-hmm. Especially after hundreds of years and having that evolve mm-hmm. into like, that's, you get into like mythos and legends there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we also need to mention, and I'll get into this in a second more, Saxo Grammaticus is writing from a Christian viewpoint.
Mm.
And that radically changes everything, how we have to view his story. Because he concedes that Lagertha was a very important person to both Ragnar and history and success. But within the Gesta Danorum, we have multiple volumes. Volume 9, like kind of like 1 through 9, is some like early history, more folklore, more like origins of this stuff, and then we get into like military leaders in some of his later books.
Yeah.
And we see her appear around volume 9 when we're dealing with those royal figures still, but not a lot from those early documents, from those earlier volumes, can be verified.
Mm-hmm.
He may have accidentally, through those oral histories, tied and compiled a bunch of old legends and tales into these volumes. And if that's the case, Lagertha and Ragnar, for that matter, Ragnar, who's written about in multiple accounts, may not have even been the person we thought him to be.
Yeah.
Which is really hard, because we know, like, the Greek gods are separate from their history.
Mm-hmm.
We can usually pick those apart pretty well.
Right.
This is not one of those instances. Yeah. We don't.
And then that's a good point, because how they're referred to in Greek text mm-hmm. is clearly, this is a god, not a man.
Mm-hmm.
And this is our mythos, not, you know, normal people.
Yeah.
But the Vikings don't have that distinction. Mm-hmm. They're just kind of like, this is a legend.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to make it real clear if it's a legend or not. So is it mm-hmm. a legend, or did these things actually happen?
Yep.
Who's to say?
And after like 5 generations of people mouth to mouth doing that.
Right.
We don't
right.
have.
Yeah. And like, yeah. you know, and that brings around the conversation of like, does it matter that these people existed?
Right.
Because if this is a story that lasted and was obviously significant enough to last in the Viking culture,
mm-hmm.
what is more important, the value of these people literally existing, or the value mm-hmm. and what you can tell was important to Viking society
mm-hmm.
from these kind of stories being right. so prevalent, you know?
Well, and at this time in history too, Vikings are not blind to Christian influences.
Right.
Like Christianity yeah. exists at this yeah. point, and they're seeing it come at them from all sides. They're seeing multiple other gods presented to them and other ideas and religions. So their concept of holiness and religion, who's to say that they didn't think that they were, when Lagertha rushes onto a field, maybe a mere woman, maybe they think this has to be some sort of god.
Right.
She's so powerful. She's yeah. so beautiful. Maybe this is a god incarnate. Like there's so many different religions yeah. and ideas overlapping here. And yeah. I'm not saying that Vikings inherently yeah. believe in gods incarnate, but like.
Right. Well, and then it's also like, again, on the same line of like, she might not have existed,
mm-hmm.
but that's not the important part. The important part is that people
believed she
existed, and then. Well, just thought that story was important enough to tell over and over again.
Yeah.
And
make like, part of their foundational.
Exactly. Yeah. yeah. And that becomes part of their culture. And mm-hmm. from that, you can be like, oh my God, they valued women in battle.
Yeah.
And found yeah. beauty in women in battle. Mm-hmm. And it tells you, again, it tells you a lot about that culture's values
mm-hmm.
more than, because, you know, like there's obviously the Viking pantheon and everything too.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And you can learn. Everything. It's just really interesting to the stories like, that Thor stick
Loki,
around.
Yeah, like Thor yeah. and Loki being part of Marvel is an example of that.
Right.
Like, what has endured right. Odin? Like, what yeah. what do we hold
yeah.
important?
Yeah, and the stories that stick around in a culture tell you a lot about what that culture values.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the source material of them is not as important as the fact that they stuck around.
Yes.
Yeah.
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 It says...
Yeah.
Everything about a culture and what they hold dear.
Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, even freaking Homer. People don't even know if Homer really existed.
I know. We're like, just all like, yeah, this dude.
Yeah. But like...
The Odyssey.
You know? Like, there's so much. And it doesn't, at the end of the day, does it matter that Homer himself existed? No.
Yeah.
Like,
the fact is we have these texts
yeah.
that shaped the entire culture
yeah.
and history.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. So
it is a really fascinating way to look at that. And we have to note too, that Saxo is not an empirical source when it comes to writing women. Mm-hmm. If we look at Christian interpretation, well, not even Christian, but just like the interpretation of women from outside the Viking culture at that time, hundreds of years later, when he can't stand there and say, oh, Vikings did appreciate women or didn't want her on the battlefield. He can't write about what a reaction would have been if Lagatha mm-hmm. stepped onto a battlefield, who would have glared and who would have cheered.
Right.
Like, he can't do
yeah.
that.
No, he has no idea. Yeah.
And so we have some really misogynistic undertones. Again, like as soon as she turns on her husband, he writes her off.
Right.
And he doesn't write about her again.
Right.
And if you're in the Anglo church at the time and how they perceive women, like, it's so nuanced and so complex. So I'm really sorry to blanket statement this, but to the Anglo church at this time, and especially a lot of these upper echelons, especially for men, women are inherently sexual beings mm-hmm. made for reproduction
yep.
and to serve a purpose.
Yeah.
And that women could also, therefore, women like this that were either seducing men or putting mm-hmm. men through trials mm-hmm. to win their hand or fighting alongside them, they're corrupt and they're tempting men and they're disobeying the natural order of things. And he may very well have written Lagertha as this barbaric, I'm sorry for the word, kind of savage woman
yeah.
because it's his example of
like a bad woman.
Yes. Yeah. Like this Viking woman, look how barbaric they are. Look right. how terrible they are.
Right.
And then look at my Christian church
right.
and how we will
and
be
look
the
at
cure
how
for it.
She betrayed her husband mm-hmm. and killed him. And mm-hmm. that's like the ultimate act of,
and yes.
you know, of what's the word? What's the word? Impertinence? No. Just kind of like rebellion.
Betrayal,
yeah. maybe.
Yeah.
The ultimate act of, you know, a yeah. bad woman is to mm-hmm. not only disobey, but mm-hmm. kill her
yeah.
husband.
Yeah. And they're corrupt. And yeah. like, if you're Christian, though.
Well, and then it also brings into the question, like, what, it's a couple hundred years later. Mm-hmm. We know the Vikings weren't around for very long, honestly.
Yeah, in the grand scheme of, like, Egyptians yeah. who were around for centuries and centuries and centuries.
Right, and, well, and then, you know, they got a couple hundred years, maybe, and then they got pretty much subsumed into, mm-hmm. you know, European culture, essentially.
Yeah.
Was history already kind of looking at them as...
Right.
Savage, you know, mm-hmm. again, sorry to use the word, but, you know, what was the perception of Vikings at this time? Like, barbaric?
Yeah.
And to have this woman in that story... Like, what audience mm-hmm. is he writing this for?
Right.
Is he writing for an audience that already sees Vikings as these, like, barbaric mm-hmm. people? And, oh my God, I can't believe that these women acted like this.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really important piece of that, too.
Is he even trying to, I mean, a lot of women in this time couldn't read, but is he right. trying to cow women, like, current women with his tales of, like, if you're not Christian... You're
right.
pagan. And if you're
right.
pagan, you're like that.
Yeah.
You don't serve your yeah. purpose and you'll betray your husband.
Right.
But Christianity can cure you.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
what? Who is his audience?
Who is his audience? And that is
oh,
a huge,
so cool.
huge question. And when you think about all of... That's the really unique thing about, like, sources like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, not secondary sources, but secondary sources, I guess it would be tertiary.
This would be
point.
Tertiary at that
yeah.
point, I guess.
We're
talking about oral histories. And...
Yeah. But... Those sources that are, you know, written in the past, to what point? What was
yeah.
your goal? Because I don't think this guy was just writing about the Vikings, you know?
And he's so biased that,
yeah.
like, is there stuff that he flat out ignored?
Right.
Did he have stories of maybe
right.
Lagertha's, like, later life?
Yeah.
And he was just like, no, that's too cool. People will think she's awesome and we
right.
can't have her be awesome.
Right.
We have to have her be bad.
Yeah.
Like, Lagertha becomes, because of the way this is written, because of the way she's perceived in this time period... a bit of Christian propaganda against
yeah.
Vikings, if depending
right.
on who's reading it. Other Vikings who might be like, or people who liked the Vikings or were mm-hmm. interested in them might have been like, Lagertha's badass, like
right.
I am now.
Yeah.
But people at the time might not have perceived it the same way.
And that's true. Like, you're looking at it from your 2023 modern eyes.
And I acknowledge my bias
yeah.
here is that I want Lagertha to be
yeah.
real. I want there to have
yeah.
been an example of a woman
yeah.
who held her own.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I
mean,
I'll be open
it's
about
hard
that.
Not to, like, cling on to those stories because
yeah. I'm not gonna like lie to you about like research I found or didn't find, but like I'll admit,
right?
I want this woman to have existed.
Yeah, and you know, hell yeah, it would be badass if she existed. Mm-hmm. But to me, what's more important than her existing is that her story was deemed mm-hmm. important enough to survive. Mm-hmm. And that to me is like, because she was one woman and it would be badass if she existed as one woman, but her story mm-hmm. and the hundreds of thousands of women hearing it year after year mm-hmm. for however long existing mm-hmm. and feeling empowered even in their own small way by it. That's
almost more important.
That's so much more important than one person potentially or potentially not existing.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, oh my God.
And if she didn't exist, she may very well have been a reference to Thorgerd, who is a, like, sort of, that's the anglicized name for one of the Norse goddesses. I cannot pronounce or understand the dialectal markings of the Norse language, the unfortunately. Accents, but the temple for that goddess is actually in Norway. And it's possible that the deity was interpreted as Lagertha, who lived in Norway, not far from where the temple would have sat.
Yeah.
So who knows? Maybe a battle commenced nearby and people were like, this is Lagertha in the flesh. Yeah. Like, we don't know.
Right.
And there's some discussion, too, about how Lagertha's name in Nordic dialect would have actually sounded a lot like the goddess's name, Thorgerd, or some like certain other goddesses as mm-hmm. well. May have even sounded close to the name of a woman who was, in Norse mythology, was the daughter of a giant and mm-hmm. was a brutish and strong and aggressive and violent and powerful. And there's implications, like those implications make it very plausible that she came from mythology, not history.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because Saxo's writing is the only documentation we have of her as a physical being. But I mean, there's a chance too that the name Lagertha, if it was if it was taken from Thorgerd or one of the Norse goddesses, people saw her in battle and was like, this woman is just like the goddess. She then gave her that name.
Yeah.
We just don't know, which is so fascinating. But in the media interpretations of today, she's in TV shows with more prominence, especially that particular TV show I was rewatching.
I think you can say it's over.
Is it over?
Yeah.
Okay. It's Vikings.
Yeah.
She's.
I know. I looked her up and then I was like, oh yeah,
Catherine Winnick. Oh my gosh, she's incredible. She's gorgeous. She's amazing. She does a really good job portraying Lagertha in kind of a more Viking like context and what you would expect. Like, they do, I'm not saying that the show is an extremely historically accurate portrayal, but like it's cool to see portrayals of a society where they treat things like sexuality and hierarchy so different. She's also just a really cool actress and I think she's awesome. But there have been books written about her that portray her as a strong leader and a warrior. There was even a ballet written called Lagertha I think it's the early 1800s. I've never seen a recording. I don't know if there are recordings of it or what, but it's like inspired by Nordic stories and it was named after her and it was a kind of like partially spoken ballet and stuff. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like early mm-hmm. early in that art form, but I kind of wish I could see that. That's something I wish I could see. I would love to see fight scenes on a ballet stage. They're always so well done. She's gotten a little more attention, especially I think it's fair to say that the Vikings show is probably one of the first that really focuses on Lagertha as a main character.
Mm-hmm.
First, like, TV shows to do so. Others mention her and everything, but, like, she's probably one of, like, the key actresses, like, characters in this show. And I just really like Catherine Winnick, too. That's the may or may not have existed story of Lagertha, the Viking.
Cool.
She's awesome.
Dang. That is cool.
Yeah.
I like that. Good job.
Thank you.
Good job. Oh, man. Vikings. It's never not going to be cool.
I know.
It's never not going to be cool.
I know.
Like, come on.
It's hard, too, to talk about, like, culture and stuff, though, because, like we said, there is a great lack of, like, we have this document, this primary document from this and this and this. Like, a lot of what we have is secondhand.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or extremely biased.
Right. Yeah. Finding the truth. That's why I will always advocate for history to be really considered a social science and not an art. Not to say like being an art, like English is bad or anything, but like there is there is investigation and research and all of those things that occurs in history. I always say that like you're asking the same kind of questions that you're asking in like a sociology class, except you can't ask people literally. You have to dig it up and hope that there's the answer somewhere.
And hope it's not so biased and corrupted that it's
and hope that maybe there's enough you can piece together to answer your question, but you're asking the same exact questions as you would in a sociology setting.
Well, and unlike sociology, there's no control.
Yeah.
There's no control group. Right. Like you find what you find, and you either have to make the disclaimer that like, hey, this bias existed. We have to view it in this context. Like there is no control group.
So history is like doing history is so like, oh,
I know. I know.
Cool as hell.
So yeah.
Oh man.
Well, so, you got a recommendation today?
I do. I do. It's that time of year.
Oh.
To rewatch our favorite show.
It is finally cool enough.
I know. I watched the first episode last night. I was like, finally, I had the window open. Even though it like wasn't rainy, which is like what I wanted. But I was like, the window's open. And it's cool outside. Like, this is probably as close as I'm going to get for now. So, of course, I'm talking about The Haunting of Hill House.
Yes.
Oh, so my God.
It is one of our favorite TV shows.
Oh, my God. It's so good.
We watch it.
Oh, my God. It's
probably at least twice a year.
Oh, my God. It's so good. Like, I was, like, you know, just the first episode, which is a lot of setup, you know, but it's still, you're just,
if you're
like,
getting into it, you do need to watch past the first episode. We will disclaim that.
Honestly, if you, like, any show has, like, you need to just be introduced to everything. For me, it's about 30 minutes in the first episode when it starts really getting, getting good.
And I know a lot of people who have seen it who are like, yeah, it's pretty good. And I'm like, no, you have to watch this. This is a show to watch with a very critical lens.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, oh my God, it's so well done.
There are a few directors and it's kind of a thriller, but really it's a lot of Mike Flanagan's stuff.
Yeah.
It's really about grief.
Yeah. It's about family and it's about grief and it's about loss and it's about.
Bly Manor is like that too.
Geez, sorry, my content.
Because Bly Manor is pretty good. I enjoy it. I don't enjoy it as much as Hill House, but like everything I really like from Mike Flanagan has to do with grief as a subject for horror or thrillers. Because Midnight Mass is like that as well.
Yeah,
but Hill House just is an incredible job.
Like nothing. Like I literally love watching TikToks about it because like the people who get it, they get it.
They get it,
and it's so like.
And it's okay if you don't want to watch it critically and you're just kind of like, okay, it was a good show. But if you watch it more than once, I still catch new things like every single time.
Like, I just thinking about how masterfully that show was put together.
I know.
And
It has what is widely, not even by even by people who don't love that show, it has one of the best plot twists ever on screen. Like, you do not see it coming at all.
And it also has, like, one of the most famous jump scares of all time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which if you...
There's only about three jump scares to get through if you...
To me, so it's very... It's never really more than like thriller level kind of spooky.
Yeah.
But it's is some jumps.
It's not like a jump scare because you're going to like pee your pants. It's a jump scare because you... the subject of it you do not expect.
Right. And then it's also like... So it happens just... If you were wanting to watch the show but afraid of jumps, it happens when two characters are having an argument in a car. And so if that is happening, that's the only time that's happening in the whole show. If that's happening,
you can also look up the jump scares. It's about three, and you can like prepare
yourself.
To me,
the big one is that one. Yeah.
It's so well done every time.
And I usually like a cheap jump scare is not something I'm ever gonna, you know, but it just like jump scares are effective and there's a reason why they're effective. And this one, you were so
invested
in the argument that the characters are having
that
even you,
it's shocking.
Yes.
It's not a scare. It's a shock. And it is followed by, one of the best monologues you're going to see from a character about depression. Like
it's so good. It's so good.
We're gonna ruin this whole thing for anyone. We gotta stop.
Oh my God.
We should just have episodes where we just live react to
say we should just do a Haunting of Hill House podcast.
Why don't we just call Mike Flanagan up? Get the rights.
I don't want to mention it, but there is that new show from him.
I haven't struck work and
I haven't watched it yet either.
Yeah, but he consistently uses the same actors and actresses, though. Yeah. So, like, if you like his other stuff, you will like this. But I God, if you're gonna watch any of Mike Flanagan, Hill House, watch The Haunting of Hill House. Oh, oh my
God,
it's so good.
Oh my God, I I will go on and on and on and on and on about that show. Anyway,
we watched this like 6 years ago. It is still to our day, like to this day, our favorite show.
Yeah,
like I just think it's impeccably made.
I know. Like it just
the fan theories behind it, the whole idea that the siblings are the stages of grief. Yeah, like
I just it's like just incredible. They're. I have never seen a piece of media accomplish what that accomplishes. Especially
it
not...
It is unique, yes.
I mean, maybe a book. And I've read some killer books. But books can have... They have the freedom to do so much more mm-hmm. just by nature of what they are. TV shows? I have never seen a TV show.
The way it leaves you feeling
yeah.
is just incredibly rare. Yeah. Especially from a thriller. Yeah. Thriller. Sorry, I have the hiccups.
Well, and then I'm just super impressed that he was given the space he needed to tell that story. You yeah. know what I mean? Like... I feel like it's rare to see a show be allowed to exist in that form because like it's such a it's 10 episodes mm-hmm. and you need every minute of all those 10 episodes.
Yes, you have to. This is yeah. not a show to put on in the background.
Yeah.
If you do put it on the background, you will miss a great yeah. deal of the actual yeah. intensity of it.
Yeah. So it just like the way the story is laid out mm-hmm. and the way that like literally when I have new people watch it, I'm like, every single question that you have right now will be answered. It's not like, oh, you know, like, trust me, every single question yeah. will be answered.
You
and I just like
that show yeah. feeling fulfilled.
Yeah.
But somehow empty.
Yeah.
Ugh. It's so good.
Oh! So anyway, obviously that's my recommendation. So
yeah.
Oh my God.
That's a really good one. Mine is also weather based. I didn't start this show or anything because of it. I realize as it gets colder, check in with your old stashes of your blankets and towels and stuff like that. If you've got some stuff that you could donate to either shelters or whether that is homeless shelters or anything like that. But if you have like towels that are too old to be used or donated to like people, check with your local humane society.
Yeah.
A lot of them have outdoor kennels, and as it gets colder, it gets harder to keep the animals warm and they can't bring them all inside. So that's my recommendation, is kind of go through the stock of what you nice. Have and what you don't need anymore and make sure yeah. it goes to whoever can take it.
Yeah.
You
know? Some nice fall cleaning. I like yeah. that. I like that. Cool. Well,
I'm ready. I am so ready for your topic. Let's just jump right in. I want to know. Hit me with it.
I know. I was like, Kat's going to be so excited. Which is why I was like, hey, can we push it back like 30 minutes? Like,
I was like, yeah.
Because I was like, I don't want to cut this short by like running out of time to do notes.
Completely valid.
Okay. So the Malleus Maleficarum, which translates to the Hammer of Witches, ooh. Is the best known kind of compendium, guide, manual, treatise, tome, mm-hmm. whatever word you want to call it, on witches and how to deal with them.
Mm-hmm.
It was first published in the German city of Speyer in 1486, and it was written by a man named Heinrich Kramer. And we're going to talk about him because... Well, he was a character.
What a name.
What a name. But he didn't publish under that name. He published under his Latinized name.
Of course he did.
Henricus Instister.
Oh my God. So. Mm.
And he was a monk. He's a Dominican monk. And he was a hoot, let me tell you. This man had a chip on his back, and he did, in fact, make it every woman in Europe's problem for about 300 years.
I'm going to make this everyone's problem.
So, if you've never heard of it, the Malleus Maleficarum is essentially kind of like, not the only, but definitely the most famous manual on witch hunting and basically how to solve the witch problem. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the first, but it was the first one to be published on the scale that it was published and kind of like well received, or as received as widely as this one was. Despite it having some problems with like approval and stuff, it just became kind of part of the culture. And we'll see as... The thing about this book is that, as you know, like parts of history like this are fun to research about, but a big other side of that with this book is that this did in fact kill thousands
a lot of
women.
People. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And not just women. Men were accused
That's
of witchcraft.
True, yes,
it was
yeah.
actually about like 75-25% split. Mostly women though. And
yeah.
This book also really standardizes the ideas that we have about witches in a way that just like hadn't been done before. And we are still kind of feeling the effects of like what this book does to women. And we'll get into that a little bit later. But so it was published in 1486. And but to kind of really understand why this was published, we have to talk about Heimrich himself.
Okay.
So he was born in what is now Seelestadt in Alsace, which is in France, I think.
Don't ask me French. I can't do French.
So
I just can't do it.
Pretty early on, he joins the Dominican Order of Monks. And then he does pretty well for himself while he was in the church. He was known as very eloquent, and his sermons were really well received. And he earns the kind of approval and becomes kind of like the right-hand man of the Archbishop of Salzburg.
Wow.
Yeah, so he's... Yeah, he's
moving up fast.
Yeah, he's doing pretty well for himself. And it's because of this that he, for whatever reason, probably like pop culture at the time is turning towards, like increasingly turning towards witch hunt fever.
Okay.
We talked a couple like that episodes more, ago.
For lack of a better word, like that more possessed kind of like... Like, I'm not going to pay attention to evidence, kind of, like, witch hunt fever?
Yes, or, we're, like, okay. We're getting more and more irrational about it.
Okay.
Yes.
Not like, oh, this weird thing I can't explain happened. It's just like,
yeah.
Oh, I don't like you, so you are a witch.
Right.
Okay.
That's kind of the direction we're going.
Okay.
So, I listened to a podcast about this. It was actually, let me see if I can find it. I really enjoyed it. They did a really good job. I think it was called Museum, the podcast is called, like, Museum... Of course, my Spotify is going to take forever to load. Well, while that's loading, they talked about basically like up until this point, witchcraft had been kind of like there was like good magic and dark magic, and like magic existed. The Morbid Museum is the podcast I listened to episode about. I enjoyed it. I would recommend that podcast. But they kind of mentioned that, like, the history of witchcraft, which I don't want to get too far into this because of later things, but the history of witchcraft, essentially up until this point, because we are still merging pagan and Christian kind of cultures. There was kind of a good magic that was accepted, that was like fairies and like, you know, all
happy,
of that
pretty
kind of
fun
stuff.
Yeah,
like white magic and then like dark magic, and as long as you weren't doing the dark magic, it wasn't that big of a deal,
which is crazy because like in my brain I'm like, this is like like a fantasy novel where you have light and magic and dark.
I know.
Magic. I have to be like, oh no, that was like a thing.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
because you can't discredit like because miracles happen in the church.
Right.
The church needs people to believe in miracles. Yeah. And,
well, and then
like,
they also, like, adopt a lot of the light magic traditions, you know?
Like, so it's like you can't discredit those without discrediting certain aspects of your religion. So they had to actually do that, which is so fascinating to me. Ugh.
So, and then they also do, the podcast mentioned something really interesting that I've never fully considered before, that, like, Europe had just gone through the Black Plague, which... decimated the population. And when you have
history.
I know when you have a crisis on that scale that affects so many people without regard for who or where or when or what, it is people start looking for answers.
Yes.
And they needed someone to blame.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's thought that some of the like witchcraft in the idea of like witchcraft being bad was around before the Black Plague, don't get me wrong. In fact, the lady I was talking about a couple episodes, Alice Keitler, far before the Black Plague. I guess not far before, a couple decades before the Black Plague, but it still was around and people were still being like persecuted for it. But after the Black Plague, a lot of the witches, quote unquote, a lot of this like dark demonic activity is kind of blamed for these bad things happening,
which is not a singular event.
No.
We saw it too after Katrina.
I was gonna say
Hurricane
this
Katrina.
Is very very this,
I was about to say that sounds very familiar.
Well, I was thinking about all of this backlash to COVID and how conspiracy theories have just exploded lately.
Yeah,
because you
need someone to blame.
You need someone to blame, and when people are dying and you have this like mass event that people don't have any control over, they need someone, they need for there to be an explanation of why this happened.
It's just really interesting to see like how, because it like the Black Plague could be blamed on, like, witches, which were in this time, like you said, a lot of the persecution went to female witches.
Mm-hmm.
But post-Katrina, there was a lot of talk about, like, New Orleans being a sinful city.
Right.
That, yeah. like...
And they were getting, like, which, basically be very Sodom about, and Gomorrah.
Be very careful, too, about how, like, sinful city is predominantly...
Uh-huh. Black.
Black.
Yeah.
And the people that were affected by Katrina the most were minorities. And, like, it's very interesting.
Well, it's also very interesting, again.
Then you don't have to care because it's their fault. Mm-hmm. And it's, like...
Well, and that's the same attitude. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating because humans have always been humans.
Just...
And the same... The women were obviously a persecuted class in Europe during this time. And it was seen as their fault. It's your fault. You are being influenced by these demonic forces.
You're weak. You're,
and because you're weak, yeah. because you are not being what a woman should be. And so you allowed this evil, essentially, into our lives. Anyway, I knew this was going to be...
History repeating is so fascinating.
I was like, oh, I have so much to say about this book. So let's go back to Heinrich.
Okay, sorry. Yes, I got derailed there. Yeah.
So all of that is to say that Europe is kind of in the first real proper wave of this, like, witch craze.
Okay.
And because of this, Heinrich is like, oh, I want to hunt witches. I'll do that. And so he goes and he asks permission, basically. Can I get basically approved to, like, be an inquisitor, essentially, and, like, root out, like, heresy.
Can I basically
blah, blah, blah.
Get a free pass to do whatever I want to people?
Yes.
Yeah.
And he did. He got a...
Sounds about right. Okay.
He got a papal... He received a papal bull called Summis Deserin... It literally underlined in red because it's...
Summis Deserodontis, maybe?
Deserantis, yeah. Avectibus.
I'm trying to think about how Desire is pronounced, and it's like...
Yeah, I don't know. I don't speak Latin. And also, I don't know...
I only speak Lutheran Latin.
I don't know nearly enough about the Catholic Church to fully understand what a papal bull means. I think it's basically, like, this is your permission slip to do this.
Think of it as very loosely as a permission slip.
Yeah.
It's a grant to do something.
Yes, you are allowed. I give you my papal bull.
Yeah. Think of it as a boon.
Yeah, okay. So basically it gives him the authority to be an inquisitor to prosecute whatever he deems to be witchcraft. He gives this to Kramer himself and then another friar called Jacob Springer, which we'll talk about him later. So about a year after he receives this papal bull, he goes to Innsbruck, which is a city. And he is going there with the stated intention of, quote, bringing witches to justice.
Oh, boy. They're really going to commit to the bit here, huh?
But the problem was is that the kind of powers that be in that city of Innsbruck didn't really like him because he had already kind of made a bad name for himself. And one of the most kind of, like, baddest names he made for himself was how he handled the interrogation of a woman named Helena Schuberin in Innsbruck. He was not making a good name for himself in the city. So he accuses this woman, Helena Schuberin, and 13 other citizens of witchcraft while he's in Innsbruck. He does this because basically when he first got to the city, she already didn't like him. And this is how the story goes, that she passed him in the street, spat at him, and cursed at him publicly, stating, "Fie on you, you bad monk. May the falling evil take you." Yep.
That sounds like, honestly, if I heard someone say that, I'd be like, that does sound kind of like a curse. That's a little witchy. Yeah.
She was also described as, she was married to a very prominent and prosperous man, and so she was, like, well-known in the town. So she had a reputation of being a, quote, aggressive, independent woman who was not afraid to speak her mind. And she obviously made that pretty clear. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, as we'll see, the Malleus Maleficarum specifically cites that behavior as potential evidence. Potential. Yeah.
You could be a witch. If you stand up for yourself, mm-hmm. you might be a witch.
Mm-hmm. So, so it soon came out that she was not attending his sermons, which was a big no-no. You know, everyone had to go to church.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of all of this, he brings charges against her of witchcraft. And apparently even in one of the sermons she like had to go to, she claims that Heinrich himself obviously was so evil that he was in league of the devil himself, and he did not like her. So he, you know,
he's not really helping. Charges, at this point.
He accuses her of witchcraft, and he goes to trial. And during this trial, he is, and you'll see this in the Malleus too, he is very into sex and sexuality with women, and using that as evidence of an overly, whatever he deems is overly sexual, that's a witch. Women should not be sexual creatures.
Count Frollo, basically.
I'm like, you've got issues, guy.
This sounds like a not a me problem.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like you're kind of projecting here.
Yeah.
However, this really discredits his argument, and eventually the bishop of Innsbruck is like, no, she's not guilty. There's no evidence that says she's a witch. You just don't like her. And so...
Heaven forbid.
So she gets acquitted. She's not a witch, which, like, luckily for her. But it does mean that, like, now Kramer even has this, like, bigger chip on his shoulder. Which, if you can't tell, he's already got a chip on his shoulder about women. And so they kick him out of Innsbruck. They're like, we don't like how you handled that. We don't like what you're doing here. So they go. And he goes back to Cologne in Germany. Because he got basically the boot and was criticized, Kramer was not going to have that. And he begins to write.
You know, he's been offended by a woman. And he must retaliate.
Mm-hmm. And he, this is basically the inciting incident that like prompts him to write the Malleus Maleficarum. This interaction with this woman how he was, you know, like Heinrich Kramer.
Like a monk scorned.
So this whole, and you can see like throughout the Malleus Maleficarum is how this, like how the treatment of this woman affected his view on what witches were. Cause it kind of feels like he wrote the whole thing to
based
be like,
on their experience.
To prove that that woman was actually a witch.
Oh, I'm sure he, it's like an X, like, in, like, or the burn book in Mean Girls.
Yeah.
Do not trust this. This, any witch, not just her, any witch.
Yeah. So what's really interesting is that man, Jacob Springer, that also was on the papal bull of like the improved inquisitors. So it was first published, right, in 1487.
Okay.
But in 1519, like 24 or 5 years after Springer himself died, he's included as an author in a future printed edition. And no one really knows why he was included as an
author. Documents behind
it? No. All anyone knows, Kramer just decides that he wants to put his name on there. So there's kind of like two main things of thought. It's like Springer had a conversation with Kramer and was like, hey, yeah, just put my name on there. Like, I don't really, like, I'll do it for the clout, you know?
Yeah.
But for all reports that say, they were like, Springer didn't even really like the guy. Like,
was annoying.
They were like, they weren't friends. We have no idea why his name was on there. So just so you know, there is like technically two authors, but it's pretty much universally agreed that Heinrich Kramer was like the sole author of this.
Okay.
So the book itself consists of 5 different parts. Well, I would say 4 different parts, and then the main text, which is split into 3 sections. Sorry. So 3 sections, the main text, which is in itself in 3 sections.
Okay.
It starts off with the justification for why they wanted to write this book, why Kramer wanted to write this book. And this is the quote. And I wanted to include this because this is really like, it sets the tone for the whole thing. Lucifer attacks through these heresies at that time in particular, when the evening of the world declines towards its setting and the evil of men swells up, since he knows in great anger, as John bears witness in the book of Apocalypse, 12:12, that he has little time remaining. Hence, he has also caused a certain unusual heretical perversity to grow up in the land of the Lord, a heresy, I say, of sorceresses, since it is to be designated by the particular sex over which he is known to have power. So he is saying,
yeah,
I am writing this specifically because we all know that the devil has more influence over women than men because they are seen as like the mentally weaker sex. In the midst of these evils,
Kaylee, don't don't you know that I've been myself possessed for at least nigh on 3 months now?
I can't even respond.
Have you not seen the signs, my sister?
I did wonder why you have that, like, devil's mark on your on your arm. That's your heart monitor.
My heart monitor was just
the devil's mark.
The doctors caught it before the before he could.
The evils of modern medicine.
Honestly, if this guy found out about my heart monitor, he'd probably be like, witch.
He would call you a witch for that and a lot of other reasons. In the midst of these evils, we Inquisitors, Jacobus, I guess it would be Jacobus Springer, together and the very associate, with the very dear associate, delegated by the Apostolic See for the extermination of a so destructive a heresy, will bring everything to the desired conclusion. Naming the treatise Hammer for Sorceresses, we are undertaking the task of compiling the work for the associate. So basically they're saying, we're writing this because everyone knows that women are super susceptible, so like super, the devil can manipulate women. And we are going to tell you in this novel exactly how to deal with the women who have been manipulated by the devil.
Good, I just I needed this actually.
In case you needed that, yeah. Uh-huh. He also includes a copy of the papal bull that was issued to him that gave him the authority to like flex. Be in, literally he was like, here are my, and then
here's my and, qualifications,
and then he puts an approbation section where he basically, as far as historians knows, like completely falsifies a document that says that, so okay, it's called, it's titled The Approbation of the Following Treatise and the Signatures Thereunto by of the Doctors of the Illustrious University of Cologne follows in the form of a public document. And so this document, he implies that he has full and complete approval from like the top professors at the University of Cologne. The professors are like, we know.
That's not.
And like historians are like pretty sure that he just faked this document to put it in this book so that people would be like, wow, this guy has a papal bull and these, all of these professors like know what he's talking about.
Of course we're going to listen to him.
Of course we're going to listen to him. And you know what? It seems to have worked. So
why not?
Yeah. So, and then we have the main text. It's this book, as I mentioned earlier, really, really, really lays out witches as we kind of know them now. Mm-hmm. They have evolved in small ways since this book and like the additions of like, I don't even know if he does like the devil's mark. I don't even think he kind of like kind of talks about it, I think, but not like in the way that it evolved to be.
Okay.
And then like the idea of like a familiar isn't in the Malleus Maleficarum at all. So there's certain things that are like added as like the centuries went by. Mm-hmm. But for this is like basically the groundwork for how we perceive witches and what we think they are. So the first section, it's divided. The main text is divided into three sections. And let me tell you, this is like a tomb. This really is. It's written like, if you look at pictures of the text and how small it was, it is like columns, you know, it's like traditional like manuscript style, totally, and it's got and it's like still 300 pages, and it's like no one wants to read that, except maybe like doctorate students, but I, you know, if I was doing a doctorate on witches, I would absolutely want to read this and like really get into it, because I am sure that there's so much there
that you could just laugh all day.
Oh my god. So the first section,
a copy available on Amazon for,
yeah, you can get it. It's pretty accessible.
I'm just looking up all the old
they apparently sell it at the Salem Museum.
Oh, heck yeah.
That's like one of the pages that popped up when I Googled it. So the first section is targeted towards clergy and basically wants to prove to clergy that witches are real, and that they should be persecuting them to like the fullest extent that they can. It talks about from witchcraft from a theoretical, philosophical, and theological standpoint, and addresses the question of whether or not it's a real phenomenon. And it, you know, asserts that yes, this is absolutely real. Yes. And it's the conclusion, like the reasoning they use to prove that it's real is because the devil is real. So, and he's the one who's ultimately influencing all of these witches. So witches must, by you know, logical reasoning, of course, because we are learned men, be real themselves.
There's some, actually, I love it, old scripts, how they're written when they're hand translated, and the needlessly, like, pretty way that things are drawn to the side.
I know. There's something with that. Hold on. So since, you know, witches enter into a pact with Satan to allow, to basically enable them to be able to use his power to be witches, thus, obviously, since the devil, we believe in the devil, we have to believe in witches. What's really interesting, too, is apparently they use a lot of, like, rhetorical framing and devices that Thomas Aquinas uses. And so they're kind of leaning on, and obviously, if you know anything about theology, this is like literally like day one theology is like Augustine and Thomas Aquinas are like the two biggies. Like they are really leaning on kind of the clout and authority that a well-respected church figure from early on has. It was really fascinating to me. Okay, so that's the first section. The second section describes, like, actually how witchcraft manifests. Like, so the first section is all about proving that it exists. The second section is all about this is real and this is how it, what it looks like in the real world.
Honestly, effective way to write rhetoric. To
like it's...
Prove it, if you then think tell me about how to, it. Like, that's a, this
it's
is an
a well-organized book.
Well, no wonder it, like, took hold.
Right. I mean, what they were saying is actually absolutely ridiculous, but like the framing of it,
that's that we see it now. Like you said, with conspiracy theories, like that's how it works. Like prove it first and then tell people how to address it and how to react.
Yeah. So actual cases are discussed of witchcraft. He gives a lot of like case studies. And this is where I want to take a little quick side note of one of the more ridiculous ones in the books, of these like actual case studies that he like is like, these women are proven to be witches and this is how we know and this is what they were doing. And this also, this comes from, because the Morbid Museum podcast I listened to was really well researched, and I was like, you must have like read books on this, and I just don't have that time, so good for y'all. They gave one of the more ridiculous case studies in the books of these three examples, these three case studies that Heinrich spins talking about how witches will steal men's penises and keep them as pets and feed them like oats and grains and keep them in bird cages and have like flocks of them. And he was like, this, apparently he's like, this is well known. Everyone knows a witch who does this. This is how you know that a woman is a witch, because she will have a pet penis. This is another
response.
This is
another
example of, I think that's a you problem, dude.
I was gonna say, I think this might be a this might be something you need to see therapy for. I know. Like,
and obviously that's a pretty extreme example, but it's a lot of those typical, like, you know, this woman, you know, looked at a man weird and then he died the next day, and that's how you know she's a woman, or she's a witch, and blah blah blah. And the thing about the penis thing specifically is really interesting, because it's like, for most of history, a man's penis has been pretty symbolic of his power, right? Like, that's masculinity.
Well, I know, and I'm trying to, like, see this through a non-Freudian, like, Freud didn't exist yet, so, like, how do you perceive this? But either way I slice it, it's really hard not to see this as, like, a him being insecure about
masculinity. His masculinity is threatened.
Weak masculinity is, that a woman can own multitudes of it.
Yeah, right. And that these women, because they're not truly following what women should be doing, are threatening his masculinity and the masculinity of all other men. And that's, they have really the power to take your masculinity away from you and treat it as if it's nothing. It's just a pet. And so, like, yeah, Freud didn't exist yet, but that doesn't mean that human psychology was just not around.
Also, how much credit did he put in this? Because I'm sure I'm sure that he did not break into women's houses and say, hey, you're a witch, show me your head.
I don't know. And that's, like, the ridiculous, like, thing. It's,
I'm trying to imagine, like, he couldn't have found evidence of this anywhere.
No. He's just making crap up.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's, like, this is what I mean when I say, like, if I was writing a PhD on this, I would want to sit down and spend hours with this.
Yeah, the mere psychology of that is fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, girl, you are too far from your mic.
I know. Sorry. I am simultaneously stretching right now.
So that is obviously a more extreme example, as I said, but it's a lot of the, you know, what we kind of, all these case studies are the ideas that we have today of, like, you know, like I said, this woman cursed at me on the street and then I died. So she must have been a witch, or I got sick, so she must have been a witch, or blah, blah, blah. So this is also where we get the idea that, like, midwives specifically are really dangerous women because they have the power to basically in his mind decide if, like, babies live or die, and that's, like, a really big, the corruption of infants is, like, really big, and, like, witchcraft issues,
which is so fascinating because, like, what do you want? Women did not have any help from a midwife while they're giving birth, and
essentially
then just
yeah that's what they want, actually. It's also, you know, how women are tempted into becoming witches, and how demons, like, kind of manifest and lure women in and kind of capture them. It also details how they cast spells and how to prevent, basically, like, how to prevent witchcraft and, like, evil things from happening to you for witches, and how to help people who have supposedly been affected by witches. So it's very, like, a practical, like, boots on the ground section. And then the third section is written to specifically to judges and telling them how to handle witches. And this is really interesting because this is where we really see the witch trial kind of shape in the way that we see it now. Mm-hmm. That becomes kind of the prominent way of handling witches. Heinrich is the first guy to raise witchcraft to a heretical status. He is the first one that says this is heresy and we need to try it as heresy.
So before that, it was just its own category.
It was kind of like, hey, don't do that. It was, like, not technically allowed and you would get in trouble for it, but
so it
was
a crime, not heresy.
Yes.
Gotcha,
yeah.
Gotcha.
It was, like,
okay,
a misdemeanor, not a felony.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So he does this because he uses the verse Exodus 22:18 that says, quote, you shall not permit a sorceress to live. And so he's like, well, since, you know, the Bible says that a witch can't live, then this is obviously heresy because anyone doing witchcraft is going against the Bible because the Bible doesn't even want them to be alive. So he is kind of the first one to really elevate it to a heretical status, which obviously it takes over as the way to treat witches from this point on, that they are committing acts of heresy. Just to be clear, all witches are heretics, but not all heretics are witches.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it walks judges through how to persecute a witch. This is also, like, literally, like, how to interrogate them and how to torture them and how to, like, get witnesses. And this is also one of the first things that say that children can testify against witches and it will be, like, equally as valid as an adult testimony against like accusing someone of witchcraft, which the podcast I listened to pointed out it really was a big part of Salem and how that was handled.
I mean, it's in the Crucible too, like, yeah, like the Proctor, the whole thing with, like, Lady Proctor and everything, yeah, like, they're children,
right?
They're little,
yes,
girls.
Yeah.
And we also talked about recovered memories of the Satanic Panic, mm-hmm, and how, mm-hmm, easy it is to convince,
yeah,
children,
right? Exactly. And even back in the day they did have a conception of, like, hey, children shouldn't really be, you know, used as evidence.
Yeah.
But he was saying, well, if it's a witch, then it's a witch and a child will know what a witch is. Because his whole argument was that, oh, and let me say this before I say that. He also was like, if someone's accused of being a witch, they are guilty until proven innocent. Not the other way around. He says that you need to go into a witch trial assuming that this woman is innocent or guilty of witchcraft until she can prove without a doubt that she is not. And that obviously is not how that should work.
But, like,
Why? because Helena pissed him off. And she was innocent until proven guilty.
When you literally make a woman's mere existence proof enough of being a witch, how is she supposed to?
Because there is little to no evidence ever of supposed witchcraft.
Right.
And if you were going the innocent until proven guilty route, there is going to be basically nothing that proves them guilty.
Which, I get, but also, bro, how, tell me how a woman is supposed to prove herself guilty until proven innocent. How can she prove herself innocent when literally her existence as a woman is enough for you to convict her?
Yeah. And it was literally anything that would be extra confirmed that she was a witch, including one of the main ideas that he has during the trial is that women who did not cry during their trial were automatically assumed to be witches because, a normal woman would obviously be emotionally distraught at being accused of being a witch. They also assert, or he also asserts that God would never permit an innocent person to be accused or convicted of witchcraft.
I have heard that one a lot.
Yeah, and that's why he is saying that if someone is accused of witchcraft, they must be a witch, because God would never accuse a good woman or a good person, never allow that to happen to a good... He would step in and
save them.
Right, exactly. And so they must be a witch, because...
Regardless of the fact that, with the bubonic plague, tons of innocent people died. Right. So and obviously,
regardless of free will,
there's not a whole lot of the whole God will save anyone who's innocent going on right now.
Yeah. So it also explicitly recommends torture and lying to women to get confessions out of them.
Oh, okay.
Just accused witches, I should say. It is also it also really advocates for the whole throw her in a lake, and if she lives, she's a witch and we'll kill her, and if she dies, she wasn't a witch, but so well. And it was that whole thing. It was that's how they would try witches, because there was no evidence to be brought forward, and so they had to prove somehow, and usually that proof was ways that would kill women unless you were a witch,
I am sure that the mentality for this dude was, if a couple of innocent women die in the pursuit of
getting
rid of all these witches, the cost is greater.
Oh, so sad.
It's still less than the payout.
Well, and then when you have convinced yourself that God would never let a woman die, who was innocent of this.
Which is funny, because you then already carded women as inherently sinful.
Yeah, exactly. So the quote about torture, this is a quote from it that talks about, but he spends a while talking about torture methods, but he says, quote, "And when the implements of torture have been prepared, the judge, both in person and through other good men zealous in the faith, tries to persuade the prisoner to confess the truth freely. But if he will not confess, he bids attendants make the prisoner fast to the strappado or some other implement of torture. The attendants obey forthwith, and yet with feigned agitation. Then, at the prayer of some of those present, the prisoner is loosed again and taken aside once more, persuaded to confess, being led to believe that he will in that case not be put to death." So, one, we can tell a couple things from this. One, this is literally an instruction manual. You do this, and then you do this, and then you do this, and that's how you get a confession. Two, we are actively admitting to lying to people to get a confession out of them.
Yeah. There's no due process here at all.
No. Just complete and utter, you are going to be a witch whether that's true or not. I am making this entire manual for you to basically foolproof accuse someone of witchcraft and them die.
Good luck them trying to get out of this.
So I jumped the gun, but then, the whole thing about if let's see if she'll be drowned or she'll be burned. And if she's not drowned or burned, she must be a witch. And if she is, oh, well, she's dead. So she must have been a witch. There's literally no way out of it. It does spend some time talking about men being witches versus men being witches. The book does say that men can be witches. It does not deny that men cannot be witches. However, it says that witches are usually female because women are, quote, prone to believing, and because the demon basically seeks to corrupt the faith, he assails them in particular, and that they, quote, also have a temperament towards the flux and loose tongues, and that they are, quote, defective in all the powers of both soul and body. He also says that they are more lustful than men, they are more carnal than men, and all of these things are used to corrupt them by the devil, which is fascinating to me, because when we think about history, we think about history through the Victorian ideal and depiction of men and women. And it's this idea, the Victorians had the idea that women were these holy creatures, they need to be protected, and that men were the ones who were the corruptors. Men were the ones who could ruin women, and men were the ones who needed to be, like,
held accountable.
Yeah. They were the danger one.
Yeah.
But for a lot of history, at least in the Western mind, women were the corruptors, and men were the ones who were going to be corrupted. Women were the seductresses.
It's really interesting too to see how Victorian times, even before that, I mean, we see it in Birth of a Nation, specifically white women, this standard is upheld.
Yeah.
You know, like, and because it is important to note, I think that, like, the, I don't know as much about Afro-Caribbean religions and stuff like that as, like, as post-war. Yeah. But there's a lot of talk about how, like, a lot of those religions morphed with tenets of Christianity that enslaved people were forced to observe, and it creates a lot of the religions that we have now that still exist. And so, like, white women are the holier than thou, cannot be touched, easily to corrupt.
But
but men of color specifically, like,
are the danger.
White men are often, like, the saviors.
Yeah.
Men of color were the perpetrators and corruptors. Yeah. And if you look at how African American women are seen, especially enslaved women, they were temptresses. They were what steered men away. Like, and it falls very closely along that, that color line. And to see how people view things like post-Civil War religions among African American, especially previously enslaved communities, it's very interesting to how quickly and how easily we demonize along those same lines of corrupter versus corruptee. Right.
Yeah, there always has to be blame always needs to be placed somewhere for who's going to be the corrupted and who's going to be the corrupter.
And that religion usually coincides with minority.
Yeah. And, like, even when we just look at white culture in the Victorian times, the men were still deemed
as the corruptor. Dangerous. Yes. Yeah. They were rakes.
Yeah,
they were,
right.
They spent too much time in the billiard halls.
Right, and, yeah. And women had to be protected. They literally, like, the whole idea of separate spheres so that women did not have to deal with the real world, and they could just stay in their perfect little bubble where
nothing affected them. Men had to call on them to flirt and court them at their home where they were safe and chaperoned.
Right. And so it's fascinating to see such a complete 180 of what was kind of the predominant idea about women for a long time.
Yeah.
Of, like, they were the ones who were
seductress.
And they, and the men had to, you know,
evil.
Be the ones. And they weren't even protected. They weren't protecting other men the same way that women were protected. But they had to be the ones who were, like, true and powerful and
uphold law.
And uphold everything. And that women,
the moral justice.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, and I think that's the big thing. I heard this a lot in church growing up, that, like, men being the spiritual leaders of the household, not just the physical or breadwinners, but men are the spiritual leaders of the household. And I did hear that a lot growing up. Like, I'm not saying every, you know, LCMS Lutheran church heavily promotes that, but I heard it, and about how it's the man's role to steer the family in the right direction.
Yeah.
And that is a moral failing for them if they don't.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a really interesting flip from our normal context, that I think that father, paternal, controlling figure, where does that, like you said, where does that switch come in?
It's just really, really interesting. And the whole, like, gender dynamics and everything, and it also just completely reminds you, and this is, I am purely speaking Western European culture. I am not talking about any other world or any other country, any other time and place, like, purely European culture from, like, 1400 up. Like, and even when I'm talking about witchcraft in basically every other culture is dealt with incredibly different than how it's treated in Europe. And it's just like really like the whole like, you know, gender is literally a construct. It's literally whatever right. suits the society's needs for what each gender mm-hmm. needs to do and what role they have in that society. It's just it's so interesting. Anyway, so where was I? Okay, yeah. It goes on to say that, quote, women, therefore, is evil as a result of nature because she doubts more quickly in the faith. So, again, they mm-hmm. were not seen as that spiritual leader. Yeah, exactly. So they were more easily influenced and they doubted more easily. So they were more susceptible to the devil and, you know, the allure of witchcraft. This is all why, for all of these reasons, why men could be witches, but it was not as mm-hmm. prevalent as female witchcraft. So another thing that the Malleus Maleficarum really puts forward kind of for the first time, and we see this starting in the late 1200s, but it kind of like finally puts it into words, is the idea that like Satan has created whole societies of witches and that it's kind of like this underground like
satanic panic, like
yeah,
it's a network.
Literally, yes, yeah. And that, you know, he's got all of these people working under the, you know, outside of the just realm, you know, what's the word, in the background, controlling mm-hmm. everything, blah blah blah. And yeah, so to kind of summarize everything, one historian puts it into this, that the Malleus Maleficarum asserts that kind of these ideas are what it creates witchcraft to be. quote, it's a pact entered into with the devil. Okay. It involves sexual relations with the devil, because again, sexuality was a really big thing for Heinrich. Like he was like obsessive about it to a point of like, dude,
chill,
you've got something going on. That they also like receive powers of some sort, that they are an assembly presided over by Satan himself. So again, it's that like there's like a whole society of it.
Mm-hmm.
That they practice bad magic. I'm not going to try to say that right now. Mm-hmm. Maleficent magic. And that it includes like slaughtering babies, which is, you know, a big one. And again, that last one is like, you know, the midwife thing is seen as kind of the worst women around, because they ultimately are able to empower women with the choice to terminate or not be pregnant at all.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of this kind of still around a little bit more than I'd like it to be.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like an overview summary of the text itself. And now I'm just going to talk a little bit about like the legacy of it, just a little bit, and kind of what it did. We've talked a lot about this already, just because I knew I couldn't wait till the end to talk about a lot of this stuff. But
yeah.
So between in the first 30 years of its publication, 20 different editions were published, with another 16 between 1574 and 1669. So the last edition of this book was published in 1669. So not the most published book in the world, but published enough, because it's not like every person, like, you know, it's not like you and I are picking up the new copy of the right. Hunger Games book, you know,
right.
Like it's
right. Yeah.
This is a very specific manual for judges and people who are like members of the church who were these inquisitors on how to deal with witchcraft. Interestingly enough, this book was condemned by both the church itself, the Catholic Church, and the same top theologians at the facility of the University of Cologne, that he said, hey, these guys love it. That they're like, no, that's not true.
Please don't put our name yeah. with us.
Despite this, though, even though I didn't have like official recommendation by the church, I think like it was something like at one point for like a little bit, the church did like it, and then someone else took over and was like, no, don't do that, if I'm remembering right. Because we talked about it in undergrad, this book. Mm-hmm. But it never fully became like, you know, something the church was like, yes, this right. is exactly right. In fact,
this represents all of our beliefs yes, on the yeah. subject.
And in fact, a lot of the thought on the church was like, this is actually anti-Christian. We don't like what you have to say in this. Despite this, though, it kind of like it published right at the right time. The printing press had just been like really used widely and it kind of spread like wildfire because we have this increasing fervor against witches and so it just kind of took hold and it became kind of like the foundational text of dealing with witches in Europe. There's a lot of other texts that talk about like, and you know, this is not the only one by any means. There's a lot of other demonology and like how to deal with witches texts and everything, but like this is the big one when we talk about it. And it's crazy to me that I had never even heard of it until college.
I know.
And I guess because it's so specific that like when you're talking about like witch trials, and you don't have a lot of time in a high school classroom to spend talking about witch trials.
Right. You read The Crucible in English class, and then Salem gets mentioned for like one day
exactly.
in history.
Yeah, if you're going to talk about something, you're going to talk about Salem because we're in America, you know? So it kind of really takes hold, and eventually this text is used and approved of by both Protestants and Catholics alike, which is like not great when you have both of those groups kind of uniting on something. And as I said before, for as ridiculous as it is now, and obviously we know that it is ridiculous, this book actively endangered and was the direct result of thousands of women dying throughout the whole witch craze, witchcraft craze in Europe and into America. So that is the Malleus Maleficarum.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. My brain is still trying to process, is trying to go through everything I know about history and really like figure out where we see that switch from women being witches and evil and inherently sinful by their existence to why are women the pure ones to be protected. And I'm thinking like enlightenment, scarcity of women during colonialization, like there's so many factors, but it's like that could be such a long drawn out that could be an incredible episode, but man, is it
I think
a lot.
For me, as men sought to kind of, and I this is totally just something I'm coming up with now, I have no real, you know, I people I'm sure have written a lot and have a lot of thoughts about that, but for me it's kind of like as men seek to confirm and kind of centralize their power, they have to pull power away from women, and by perceiving women as like the seductress, they're inherently giving them power, right? Because you can control that
docile woman.
You can control that Madonna figure a lot more than you can control the
Isabel.
Yeah, exactly. And if you convince women that you need to be protected specifically by me, then you take a lot of power and agency away from them.
Yeah, I'm well, and it's like, you're right. Like, where are we in the world? Where are we in communication of the world? Because up till now, it's not about power over gender, power over groups in your area. It is like, or power over like entire demographics. Mm-hmm. It is power within your community.
Right.
Like Vikings are small, like not even Vikings, but like small raiding groups. You don't have to be more powerful than like every other person in the world, you just have to be more powerful than your neighbor.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, as we see networking and expansion and the world becoming large, you're right. There, that concept of power changes. It's no longer we have to stand together and fight against these people. It's like the church has power over the people. And then does the crown have more power? And you're right. There's so many factors of like how is it easiest to control power and who is the dominant group? Mm-hmm. But also like as we expand across the world, I mean, women controlled expansion in the West massively by their mere presence because there were so few of them that men had to like defer to them.
Yeah.
And then you've got stuff like the Enlightenment, which suddenly women like Catherine the Great and other people were actually very vocal in and start setting this example of women having power.
Those instances are seen as exceptions and not the rule. Because think about Queen Victoria.
Yeah.
And how, even though she was literally the queen of England.
Yeah.
At, like, the height of its power.
Mm-hmm.
she still had to fill that role that women, at least on in the public's in the public's eye,
right?
She still had to be a mother. She still had to be a wife. She still had to be seen deferring to her husband,
right?
Even though she was quite literally the Queen of England, you know.
Oh, there's just so much that goes into like the power dynamics, and that's not even accounting for like what we were talking about before of women who aren't white.
This is purely, we're just talking about Europeans right now.
Yeah.
That, like, and that's because if we talked about anyone else, we would be here literally all day.
5 hours.
Yeah. It's crazy. It's a beautiful day outside and I'd like to go to the park.
Yes. Fair, fair.
So, you know, and I want to make that clear. I'm not intentionally leaving anyone out. I am intentionally leaving everyone out because we can't talk about it.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I just am not as familiar with those histories.
Right.
So, and those cultures. So I don't feel as able to have a full conversation, a nuanced conversation about it. And that's bad on me. I should learn more.
No. But there is a certain restriction. Like, we can't do it justice.
Right.
If we don't.
Yeah.
It's better to not touch something and do it wrong.
Right.
Than to be like, hey, I think this dude might have been named this. And
let me tell you how your culture acts and feels and exists all throughout history.
Right.
Yeah. I'm going to do that for you because I am so smart.
Well, you did a fantastic job with this one.
Thank you.
You brought up a lot of cool stuff that's going to keep me thinking for quite a while, honestly.
There's so much there. I will say it again. If I was doing a PhD on this, this would be like, just get in there and like, I'd be annotating and like, like, oh my God. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway.
Great job. Fantastic.
Thank you.
We've got a cool theme coming up around Halloween, but we are always open to knowing what y'all want to learn about. We're going to have a couple weeks before we record again, but we should be releasing on our normal schedule.
Yeah.
So you can always tweet at us at TINAHL podcast.
Or you can email us at thisisnotahistorylecture@gmail.com.
You can leave reviews for pretty much wherever you're listening to us. And we'd love to hear your take, or honestly, your Freudian take on what was wrong with that dude, because there was a lot to dissect.
Yeah, there's a lot there, which is another reason why I would really want to dig into the malaise spell of the crime, because I'm like, what is going on with this guy?
But other than that, we'll be back with you next week with more fun history, and it's gonna be so fun that you might forget that this is not
a history
lecture.
Or maybe they'll remember, because history lectures can be boring sometimes.
That's true. Okay, so you'll remember that this is not
a history
lecture.
Bye.